Tonight.
Okay. It's
okay. Tonight we're going to talk about fear. Vincent van Gogh, or Gogh, once said, "I am troubled by shapeless fears. My God, these anxieties. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them?" So consider that he was writing in the late 19th century when he said that, and how much more true it is today. Anxiety is rampant in our society, wouldn't you say? In many different forms. If you look in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, you will find a lengthy list of obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, acute stress disorder, generalized anxiety disorder due to a general medical condition, substance-induced anxiety disorder, and anxiety disorder not otherwise specified. And that's not the most recent edition. There are probably others in the latest edition of that reference work. And this is one of the safest societies in the world, or places in the world to live in. You know, ours, our own. Fear is perhaps our most primal emotion. It's the flip side of anger. So along with anger, a response to a threat that triggers our fight, flight, or freeze response. So our discussion today will really be a continuation of our discussion of anger last week. Fear and anger go hand in hand, don't they? Scratch the surface of anger, and often there's fear just beneath. Or scratch the surface of anger, and often there's shame just beneath. And that's what we're going to talk about next week. The more we really investigate these states, the more we see that they're kind of synergistically related. One feeds another, or they cycle into each other. Some of us more habitually respond in fear mode, and are more conditioned to inhibit anger, and others of us more habitually respond in anger mode, and fear is unacceptable. And there's we could point to gender differences, you know, differences in gender conditioning around that, quite possibly. Anxiety and fear. What's the difference? Any thoughts?
My sense is that there are realistic, fear can be realistic, whereas anxiety is a fear that I have projected into the future, but a fear can be actually reality based. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's making that clear. But.
Yeah, I think you are. That may or may not be so. This anxiety can certainly arise from actual experiences. But generally speaking, fear is more specific and more acute. And anxiety is more diffuse and more ongoing. But that's just a generality, a general distinction, and they really overlap quite a lot. You know, you could say degree, but it's not just a matter of degree either, because, you know, anxiety can be extremely strong and pervasive. So we're not going to worry too much about drawing a fine line between, and it's fine to use both words in our discussion. it is important maybe to note that in everyday conversation the terms are used pretty subjectively and sometimes rather a little bit sloppily. Then there's, if thinking in terms of terror, you know, I was just terrified. I couldn't get the spaghetti stain off my sweater, my best sweater. Right? So sometimes we're kind of loose with our terminology, but we're not going to worry about the difference too much right now, tonight. What are the things we as human beings fear most? Loss, death, loss,
failure,
wrongdoing.
And what's the fear of there?
Causing harm.
And how do you feel when you cause harm?
Regret.
Yeah, so it's kind of the fear of the feeling of regret or guilt, or in the case of failure, often shame. Often our fear is around having an aversive feeling. Yeah.
Unfamiliar goblins.
Pardon me?
Unfamiliar things.
The unknown.
Yeah.
Yeah, the unknown. Pain. Yeah, lots. I mean, there's a lot to be afraid of in the world. um, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha made a list of the biggest, the top five. And the Buddha's top five were, and I don't think these are in order, but he put fear of loss of livelihood. That's a big one for a lot of people. Fear of disrepute. So that's, yeah, you know, kind of failure, but also losing your good name, yeah, your reputation. Fear of embarrassment in assemblies. You know, public humiliation. Public speaking, right? That's right up there in the top five. Fear of death. And fear of an unhappy future destiny. Some kind of future misfortune or pain, yeah. So those were the Buddha's top five. The earliest, in later commentaries, there's a slightly different grouping. And they are, fear of death comes at the top, fear of loss of livelihood, fear of unusual states of consciousness, loss of one's mind. Mm. You know, a lot of fear of dementia these days. Dementia is in the press because the numbers are so increasing. And as we age, some of us start to forget things and think, oh, is this it? I've heard so many people say that. Fear of illness and fear of public speaking makes the top five again. Something about fear of public speaking, I think. How many of you have experienced that? Yeah, I mean, practice helps, right? But there's something about, I think there's something pretty atavistic, pretty primal about being exposed in a group of humans. I think it must be a very early human emotion, like the arrows are going to start flying. You feel exposed to attack. That must be triggered, I suspect, in fear of public speaking, because it's so common. Before we go any further, let's do this similar little writing exercise that we did to last week. So I'm just going to say some sentence beginnings. This is a sentence completion exercise. And this is just for you. But it will tell you just a little bit about your own particular relationship to the emotion of fear. Okay. So just write down quick words and phrases, so just what comes to mind. Don't think too hard about these answers. Okay, I think of fear as... Think of fear as, next one, what fear says about me is, next one, if I fully experienced fear, I would... And last one, what I'd most like to do with fear is... Okay, so we can just set these aside for now, and I might have you look back at them a little bit later on. But I think it's important to recognize early on in this discussion that fear is functional. We couldn't survive without it, even in our relatively safe contemporary lives. Let alone in our evolutionary past. Just as those with a... Have you ever heard of people who have a genetic inability to feel pain? And what happens to them?
They hurt themselves a lot.
They are subject to repeated serious injuries because they can't tell when they're bumping into things or when something's hot. So they're really in trouble. So just as those without the ability to feel pain are at risk, those without a healthy sense of fear are also at risk, in danger. They fail to avoid dangerous situations. But of course, our fight, flight, freeze response can become overactive and not serve us well. Let me just read to you what happens. This is a really, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this book, Buddha's Brain by Rick Hansen. It's quite good and relates current neuroscience with our practice of mindful awareness. This is his description of what happens when our stress response is triggered. Within a second or two of the initial alarm, your brain is on red alert. Your sympathetic nervous system is lit up like a Christmas tree, and stress hormones are washing through your blood. In other words, you're at least a little upset. What's going on in your body? Epinephrine increases your heart rate so your heart can move more blood, and dilates your pupils so your eyes gather more light. Norepinephrine shunts blood to your large muscle groups. Meanwhile, the bronchioles of your lungs dilate for increased gas exchange, enabling you to hit harder or run faster. Cortisol suppresses the immune system to reduce inflammation from wounds. It also revs up stress reactions in two circular ways. First, it causes the brainstem to stimulate the amygdala further, which increases amygdala activation of the sympathetic nervous system. Don't worry about all the terms, just get the general gist of this, okay? Which produces more cortisol. Second, cortisol suppresses hippocampal activity, which normally inhibits the amygdala. This takes the brakes off the amygdala, leading to yet more cortisol. Reproduction is sidelined. No time for sex when you're running for cover. The same for digestion. Salivation decreases and peristalsis slows down, so your mouth feels dry and you become constipated. Your emotions intensify, organizing and mobilizing the whole brain for action. Sympathetic nervous system arousal stimulates the amygdala and is hardwired to focus on negative information and react intensely to it. We talked about this last week, how we have a bias towards remembering and reinforcing negative threats more strongly than positive events. Consequently, feeling stress sets you up for fear and anger. As limbic and endocrine activation increases, the relative strength of executive control from the prefrontal cortex, so these are your higher brain functions, declines. It's like being in a car with a runaway accelerator. The driver has less control over her vehicle. Furthermore, the prefrontal cortex is also affected by sympathetic nervous system arousal, which pushes appraisals, attributions of others' intentions and priorities in a negative direction, which is a little bit what you just described. You projected his motivations negatively, and that's what automatically happens when our stress hormones fire up. So it's kind of reassuring a little bit to have this understanding of how our brain works, because we don't need to take it so personally. We don't need to feel so kind of stupid for our own reactions. We can say, yeah, this is what's going on. I'm not in my best judgment right now. As soon as we notice, we can breathe and take a step back and keep our mouths, you know, and refrain from reacting in that place. He says, in the harsh physical and social environments in which we evolved, this activation of multiple body systems helped our ancestors survive. But what's the cost of this today with the chronic low-grade stresses in our lives? We're firing up all those stress hormones and then not releasing them through running physical action. In fact, the freeze response is the one that's actually most toxic to us because we don't discharge those stress hormones. So if we're not going to deny fear, which isn't useful, or try to banish it, or numb out and not feel it, or if we're not going to act out and in an aggressive way, what are we going to do? And I'm not talking about cases where we simply have to jump back out of the way of the oncoming bus. I'm talking about those low-grade, everyday firings up of fear and anger. Well, what our practice proposes is that we cultivate our capacity for moment-to-moment awareness of body and mind. Doing a time check. Fear is rejected in our culture. It's considered weak, irrational. It gets in our way. It's an obstacle. When Franklin D. Roosevelt said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." You've heard that quote? Yeah. It might have sounded reassuring to the Depression-era Americans of his time, but think about the message. What if our leaders, our political leaders, were able to say, "These are fearful times, and let us acknowledge our fear, support each other, and encourage each other to take skillful action to address these circumstances. Let us not be paralyzed by our fear, but let us not deny our fear." That would be different. Often, self-help books use the language of aggression to talk about coping with fear. We're encouraged to conquer our fear or overcome our fear. But this is tricky. If we see fear as an enemy to be beaten, aren't we more likely to judge and shame ourselves when it rears its ugly head again, when we thought we had it licked? Aren't we more likely to shame and judge a friend or a family member who's in the grip of fear? How helpful is that? So I'm not suggesting that we indulge our fear or feed our fear, or that it doesn't take a lot of courage to face fear, because it does. But I think the practices that we talked about, particularly the first week of the class, that Miriam Greenspan, in her book, Healing Through the Dark Emotions, the three practices that she recommends are actually more effective and good for the long haul. And if you remember, they are attending, befriending, and surrendering. First, we pay attention. We know what fear and anxiety feel like in the body, so we notice when they arise. What does fear or anxiety feel like, typically, in the body?
knots in your stomach.
Knots in your stomach, yeah.
Weight here.
Weight here. Constriction, huh? Yeah, yeah. Sometimes even, you know, sort of sweaty, clammy feeling.
Your heart rate goes.
Yeah,
up.
Heart, yeah, almost palpitations. Even a feeling of slight dizziness. Yeah, sometimes, yeah. So we notice that. We notice the specific shifting texture and subtlety of these states with each breath, and we meet that experience moment to moment with kindness, with patience. We befriend it, that's the second. Attend, befriend. We take a curious interest in it. What does it have to tell us? Maybe it's just a brief flutter of anxiety that subsides when we recognize what triggered it and we ground ourselves in our breath. Or maybe it's a really strong and persistent habit pattern that's been triggered, and we really have to practice over and over again with patience and kindness, looking deeply into the causes and conditions, the wider story of our fear, wider context. Either way, we use this practice of moment-to-moment awareness to release the grip of fear, which is the surrender part. And sometimes it's in increments, right? Small increments. And sometimes we just turn it. It just releases. And this can be something we practice within our sitting practice, because then we're in a simplified environment and it makes it easier to pay attention and track our experience. But we can also take this into our daily life. You may remember that each of the emotions that we're looking at through these weeks has a kernel of life energy in it that has a transformative quality when we release our kind of me against the world mentality. Remember, the transformative quality of anger was wisdom, clear seeing. So the transformative quality of fear is joy, which might seem kind of preposterous. I mean, what could be more farther from fear than joy? But living in joy does not mean living without fear. There is joy in letting go, in surrendering to the way life is, laying down the burden of anxiety. And in doing so, we open to experiencing a kind of beauty and vividness in life, even in the midst of fearful and difficult situations. When we face our worst fears and stay present, there is a kind of joy in life itself, or beauty, I would say, in life itself. If we're afraid of illness or disability or death, we can consciously not avoid those things. We can turn towards and practice being present. We might choose to become a hospice volunteer to learn more about death, if that's really scary to us. Or we can practice public speaking in small groups and pay attention to how that feels. We can increase our resilience and our capacity to face life's vicissitudes, not utterly without fear, but without being paralyzed by our fear, and with integrity and with courage. There's a great quote story, but I've run out of time to tell you it, about intuition. Maybe I'll fit it in somewhere else, because it's, we really, in our culture, are conditioned to ignore intuition, because it's so non-rational. And sometimes fear is non-rational in a way that's worth attending to. So I'll try and come back to that another time, because it's a really good story. What I would like you to do, though, is consider another practice from Miriam Greenspan, and it's a really simple prayer. Now, in Zen, we're not really much on prayer, right? When I encountered this in her book, I thought, you know, I haven't been much of a prayer in a very long time. But this is a simple three-step prayer, and it consists of, help me, thank you, and I surrender. Help me, thank you, and I surrender. And actually, this is a really helpful and useful prayer. When you're having a rough patch, which I was when I read this book, and it's quite possible to reframe this little simple prayer in terms of our practice and the Dharma, so that one is not praying to some external being, but one is invoking our deepest wisdom, you know, and our deepest sense of the truth of being. And so these, I think, are actually helpful as ways of aligning our intention or our aspiration to practice with these difficult emotions. So what I'm going to ask you to do is try and maybe you can take this home, not do it now, but take this home if you like this idea, and try and make a little Dharma prayer of intention for practicing with anger or fear and or both. Using this help me, thank you, and I surrender, and I'll just give you sort of an example. And you might want to use may I as a phrase. May I receive the support of my teachers and Sangha as I bring mindful awareness to anger. May I be deeply grateful for the vast truth of the Dharma that dispels the delusion of my aloneness. May I release my anger and resentment and open to great peace. That's just an example. Now forget those words and just let something arise from your heart that might touch on your intention for practicing with these states. So that's your little bit of homework. And what I'd like you to do now is just turn to, in terms of our time, the three people nearest you.
Buddhism and our society. And